The following recording was produced by Christ Redeemer Church of Hanover, New Hampshire. The speaker is Doug Cooper. You may find more information on the church and its various resources on the web at www.christredeemerchurch.org.
Good morning. Our passage this morning is from Hebrews chapter 9, verses 1 to 14 in the NIV. If you want, you can follow along on page 6. Now the first covenant had regulations for worship and also an earthly sanctuary. A tabernacle was set up. In its first room were the lampstand and the table with its consecrated bread. This was called the holy place. Behind the second curtain was a room called the most holy place, which had the golden altar of incense and the gold-covered ark of the covenant. This ark contained the gold jar of manna, Aaron's staff that had budded, and the stone tablets of the covenant. Above the ark were the cherubim of the glory, overshadowing the atonement cover. But we cannot discuss these things in detail now. When everything had been arranged like this, the priests entered regularly into the outer room to carry on their ministry. But only the high priest entered the inner room, and that only once a year, and never without blood, which he offered for himself and for the sins of the people had committed in ignorance. The Holy Spirit was showing by this that the way into the most holy place had not yet been disclosed as long as the first tabernacle was still functioning. This is an illustration for the present time, indicating that the gifts and sacrifices being offered were not able to clear the conscience of the worshiper. They are only a matter of food and drink and various ceremonial washings, external regulations applying until the time of the new order. But when Christ came as high priest of the good things that are now already here, he went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not made with human hands, that is to say, is not part of this creation. He did not enter by means of the blood of goats and calves, but he entered the most holy place once for all by his own blood, thus obtaining eternal redemption. The blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkled on those who are ceremonially unclean sanctify them so that they are outwardly clean. How much more, then, will the blood of Christ, who, through the eternal Spirit, offered himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death, so that we may serve the living God. Amen.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's good to be here with you. This is my first time in here, not so for many of you, so I'm still trying to get my bearings here. This is interesting. You know, Ian, I thought for sure you were going to make a comment about Rivendell. You had the opportunity, you didn't do it. Yeah, maybe later. Something coming to this passage. What a passage, right? There's a lot here. Something that I have mentioned previously, maybe like a month or so ago. I'm not sure how long it's been. I said that as we get further and further into the book of Hebrews, you begin to notice certain things. You begin to notice these recurring themes that kind of like keep coming back around and around, almost like they're on a loop of some kind. Themes, they suddenly appear. I won't be exhaustive here, but things like perseverance get mentioned, things like promise and covenant. High priest, obviously, the sacrificial system in general, as we get in the early part of this passage. And then those themes, they disappear for a time, and then they reemerge, and so on and so forth. And what I had said about this is that I think that this is very intentional on the part of the author of Hebrews, and that they're doing this, you know, not merely just to remind us of things that they had said previously, although they are doing that, but more than that, I believe that they're attempting to like drill down further and further into these most precious, most important, most essential themes and truths. And so it might be more accurate, as strange as this might sound, to think of these loops as though they're part of one of those like really awesome looking conical seashells. Do you know the ones that I've got in mind? They're shaped like a cone, like they're shaped almost like an ice cream cone, and they spiral down in these really like perfect, beautiful, mesmerizing ways, and they come down to a point, the point of the cone. And that's what I believe that the author of Hebrews is doing here with each of these themes. They're bringing us further, spiraling down further, deeper into the content of these themes, bringing us to a critical point, bringing us to, I guess you could say, like a conical point. And it comes to us this morning through this most critical theme of the high priest. I think that we're actually coming to one of these points in this particular passage. Now, this high priest theme, by now, if you've been joining with us, should be sounding pretty familiar. Maybe it didn't at first, but me reminding us of things like a priest's most essential role being to bring the people to God. You've heard this from me before. To be a go-between that assists sinful, broken people whose connection to God has somehow been broken so that they can get reconnected to God, reconciled to God, restored to God. And as it pertains to Jesus as our high priest, what we've been learning is that because of who he is and because of what he's done, he has become for us our most ultimate, most perfect high priest, to such an extent that we need no other priest other than him. Any other priest would be altogether unnecessary because he is the one who once for all time, fully, wholly, has brought us to God in all the ways that we would ever need to be brought to God. He's done it. He's accomplished this. And again, as it relates to all of this, in this morning's passage, we're continuing to spiral down into this reality of the high priest. And I think that this passage brings us to like the essence of this high priestly ministry of Jesus. It's being brought out into the open. It's not that this hasn't been mentioned before. It's not that it hasn't been alluded to before, but it just, verses 11 through 14 in particular, spotlight this in such a significant way. In fact, I'd really like for us to spend the majority of our time in verses 11 through 14. And if I could just name it, atonement, his atoning sacrifice on our behalf. This is that conical point. And so we might now ask, why should this matter to us? Why should, you know, what should this mean to us? How should this impact things? How should this impact my approach to God, the ways in which I see God? These are some of the kinds of things that we're looking to get at this morning. And I've got three questions for us along these lines. Question number one, very much to the point, is simply going to be, what is an atoning sacrifice? Like, what are we talking about when we talk about an atoning sacrifice? Why is such a thing necessary? Why does such a thing exist? Question number two, what does the sacrifice of Jesus provide for us? What does it accomplish? What does it mean for us? And then question number three, how should the sacrifice of Jesus impact our lives of faith? How should the sacrifice of Jesus impact our life of faith? So we're going to begin with an atoning sacrifice. What do we mean by that? Why is such a thing necessary? Why does such a thing exist? There's a whole lot. There's a whole lot to this. This is a really dynamic reality that we're trying to unfold together this morning. There's a whole lot of history behind it. Hopefully we've been getting it, some of it along the way, but for now, I'm just going to begin with just a bit of a definition just to get the wheels turning for us. And I'm going to start with the English term atonement, the English term atonement. This is really interesting. I had never realized this. I'd never noticed this. Perhaps some of you have before, but the English word atonement, it's what you would call a compound. If you break it apart, bit by bit, it basically reveals itself, okay? So the etymology of it is built into it, I guess you could say. Atonement. At one mint. You see that? I don't know how I didn't notice this before. At one mint. To be at one with someone. And so right away, the thing that we realize about the atonement is that it's a relational thing. And so if we need it, which we most definitely do, the starting point of atonement begins with the realization that we are not at one mint, you could say, with God, but that we need to be, all right? We desperately need to be. We need to be reconciled to him. We need to be restored to him. We need to be at one with him. This is so critical to our understanding of atonement. In particular, it's so critical to our understanding of the atoning sacrifice of Jesus. Now, the Hebrew word for atonement is kippur, if I'm saying that right, and it has two shades of meaning, both of which are super important, super essential, both of which apply here. So on the one hand, a kippur, atonement in the Hebrew, refers to a kind of ransom, to essentially pay off a debt that is owed. And in this case, the debt is, and I was thinking about this, I'm like, I'm not really sure how to say this. You know, do I say that the debt is life, or do I say that the debt is death? It's like kind of both. I guess you could say that death for life is the debt that must be paid. In which case, to be atoned for would mean that we would be released from the required payment of a debt that we most definitely have earned, that we most definitely owe, and that would otherwise lead to death for us. So to be set free from that debt is what atonement would do for us. So that was one shade of the meaning of this Hebrew word kippur. And the other shade of meaning, which is also essential, is to purify, to cleanse. You could even say to make right what has become wrong. If you're going to put this, you use like a theological term, you would say to be made righteous. This is the other side, the other shade of meaning behind atonement. And a word that is often used when you hear conversation about atonement is the word substitute or substitutionary. Substitutionary atonement. Those words often come together. If you're thinking about this word substitute, the most obvious thing that's coming to everybody's mind probably is substitute teacher. You don't need to think about, you know, like, traumatic experience with substitute teachers that you've had in the past, or wonderful ones maybe. I've heard it all, but that's not what we're talking about here. In this case, the substitute stands in the place of another in such a way that they experience death. They die the death so that the other might live. They die the death of the other, so that the other might live. And actually, this is something that I'm sure that we all understand to some degree, that we've seen this sort of thing. For instance, all of our best stories, isn't this how all of the best stories go? They involve some type of substitutionary individual, some kind of substitutionary reality. Going back as far as you can go, all of the best, most celebrated stories almost always include this substitutionary reality. Most of our favorite novels almost always conclude with the main character doing this thing, heroically laying down their own life in order to save other lives. I was thinking about this, was remembering as a kid. I'm going to bring out a story that you're not expecting me to bring out, by the way. I think I admitted this not that long ago. I was not the best student, right? So it took a lot to get me to read a book. But there were some. There were a few books while I was in school that I came across that I just really enjoyed and just I tore through them. One of the first books that I can recall reading while in school that involved like class discussion and this sort of thing that I really enjoyed was The Outsiders by S.E. Hinton. Anybody? I really liked that story as a kid, okay? One of the main characters was Johnny Cade. If you saw the movie, it's played by the Karate Kid, right? No? 16-year-old kid from a broken home. He was a greaser. This is why I like this. There's greasers. I liked greasers, you know what I mean? Man, I got tricked, basically. I got tricked into reading a really good, meaningful life lesson book because they snuck some greasers in there. They tricked me, you know what I mean? The nerve. But Johnny Cade, he dies in this story. I'm sorry if I'm giving it away. If anybody has, I'm sorry. Apologies. Johnny Cade dies in the book. He does something that the Socs, the folks on the other side of the track, this is the wealthy, preppy kids. Johnny does something that the Socs would have never dreamed that a greaser would have the heart to do. He lays down his life to save others. And it takes place in a church, this rescue. Takes place in a church. There seems to be a lot of truly intentional symbolism built into the book. The church catches fire. There's a group of children in there. Johnny and his friend, they put their lives at risk. They get all the kids out. As a result, Johnny experiences really terrible burns. His back is broken. He eventually dies. And it's a very, very moving thing. It was for me. It was for me. When I read it, when I saw the movie, the whole nine, it was very moving. And I don't think that it was a mistake on the part of the author that Johnny Cade's initials are JC. Okay? Like, this is intentional. I mean, for, like, you know, literary nerds, you know this, that there's like, often what they call a Christ figure embedded in the story. And this was Johnny Cade. Johnny Cade was the Christ figure in The Outsiders. Might make you look at the movie a little bit different or read the book a little bit different next time. And he died that others might live. However, what I'm explaining there about Johnny Cade, that really only gets at one shade of this meaning that I was describing a moment ago, doesn't it? It only gets to one side of it. He could save their lives, but he couldn't purify their lives. He couldn't make others right. He couldn't do that. In fact, although it was unintentional, if you know the story, you know what happened. Like, Johnny and his buddies were the ones who actually started the fire. They left a lit cigarette in the church. It caught fire. Okay? Why were they in the church in the first place? They were hiding out. Why were they hiding out? They were on the run from the police. Okay, so, you know, in a sense, these characters, they're not unlike, maybe this is a bad characterization of Old Testament priests, but they're not unlike the Old Testament priests in the sense that they themselves, they needed purification. They couldn't truly make someone truly right. They couldn't atone. They needed their own sins to be atoned for. But once again, why? Why is such a thing necessary? This talk of atonement, why is this necessary? Why does such a thing exist? And what we learn throughout the Old Testament is that animal sacrifice was introduced to address all the things that I've mentioned so far. Animal sacrifice was introduced to put us at one, at one-ment with God. It was introduced to purify us in order that we could be at one with God. It was introduced to pay the debt of our sin, which is a debt of death. And you can hear a lot of this in verse 7 of our passage that you've got in front of us. This is referring to the Day of Atonement. That's what verse 7 is referring to, this annual day in the life of the Jewish people. It says this: only the high priest entered the inner room, and that only once a year, and never without blood, which he offered for himself and for the sins of the people, and the sins the people had committed in ignorance. And this talk of blood sacrifice, which to some may sound archaic. I don't know what you're thinking as you're hearing this morning. But one of the first places that we explicitly read of this in the Bible is in Leviticus, okay, which is essentially like the the hand manual of the Old Testament for their system of worship and sacrifice. And I'm just going to read just one very important, very enlightening verse from Leviticus, chapter 17, verse 11. It says this. It says, the life of the flesh, it's talking to us about sacrifice. It's framing these things for us. The life of the flesh is in the blood. And of course, we all know this to be true, right? We understand this. If you are riven, okay, and if you bleed out too long, you will lose your life. The life is in the blood. In other words, why all the blood? Why all this sacrifice? Why all this talk of blood? What's the blood? What's all this about? The life is in the blood. The blood is representative of the life. So again, Leviticus 17:11, I haven't finished it yet. God says this, the life of the flesh is in the blood. And I, God, have given it for you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that makes atonement by the life. Substitution, right? And if we're listening there to what I just read from Leviticus 17, contrary to how we might want to think about this, it was God who gave this to us, is what it's telling us, not the other way around. It was God who did this. He gave this provision. He introduced this provision for us to make atonement for our souls, is what it said. He provided at-one-ment and purification and ransom for us. And this is always the case as you look throughout the scriptures. Going back to the Garden of Eden, this is a subtle scene. It's not super explicitly stated, but this is the first sacrifice that we read of in the Bible. Is it takes place in the garden, where God makes the sacrifice himself. God does it. He made it on behalf of Adam and Eve. They were hiding, remember, in the trees. Where are you? And they had made their own little covering, and it was insufficient. And so God provided them what they needed, a true covering, a covering for their bodies, a covering for their sin. He came to them. They didn't come to him. He came to them. He found them. He provided for them, not the other way around. Okay? And this is ultimately what we see and experience in Jesus in full. And this brings us into our second point now. What does the sacrifice of Jesus provide for us? Let's pick things up at verse 9 now. So speaking of this Old Testament sacrificial system that gets a lot of ink in the first few verses of this passage, the author writes the following, verse 9, this system of sacrifice is an illustration for the present time, is what they write. So it's something, I think what they're saying is, it's something like a picture. It's something like a shadow of the real thing without being the real thing itself, if that makes sense. It's an illustration. This is an illustration for the present time, indicating that the gifts and sacrifices being offered were not able to clear the conscience of the worshiper. Verse 10, they are only a matter of food and drink and various ceremonial washings, external regulations applying until the time of the new order. Until the time of the new order. Now verse 11. But when Christ came as high priest of the good things that are now already here. So what are we supposed to hear in that? This is speaking of that new order that was mentioned at the end of verse 10. The new order, the new covenant is now already here, the author is saying. Back to verse 11, but when Christ came as high priest of the good things that are now already here, he went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not made with human hands. That is to say, is not a part of this creation. This is kind of some confusing stuff. I'm going to try to explain this. What is being said here? Where Jesus went in order to enter into the presence of God, in order to present an offering to God for sin, was not into a tent. He didn't go into a tent, okay? He did not go into a tabernacle. He did not go into a temple. He did not go into an inner section of a man-made anything. No. He went someplace else, and this should remind us of things that we've looked at and studied in the past. This should remind us of Hebrews chapter 4. Maybe you remember this. Verse 14 of chapter 4. Since then, we have a, remember that spiral? You know what I'm saying? Like we've been around these things and we're kind of getting down deeper into them. Chapter 4, verse 14. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. This is getting at it, okay? This is getting at it. The idea in verse 11 of our passage is that Jesus entered into the proper place of God's presence in the heavens. The real McCoy, not the picture. And this is what he did after he endured the cross. This is what he did after he was raised from the dead. This is what he did. He ascended into the heavens. Now, what did he enter there to do, we should ask? What was he doing? Verse 12 now. Verse 12. He did not enter by means of the blood of goats and calves. He didn't adhere to the old ways of doing things, is what we're being told. But he entered the most holy place once for all by his own blood, thus obtaining eternal redemption. And so we've just arrived at this critical, conical point of the shell, if I can put it that way. Jesus didn't bring an outside sacrifice. Jesus, the Son of God. He did not bring an outside sacrifice into the presence of God as an offering. Rather, he was the sacrifice. Behold the Lamb of God, who takes away the sins of the world. His blood was the blood that was shed for the remission of sins. His life, we're learning, was the life that was given to put us at one with God. For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. His life became the ransom, you see. He became our ransom. He paid our death debt. God provided what was needed. He came to us. He found us. He provided for us. He provided a covering for us. And so Jesus entered into the proper place of God's presence in the heavens, and he brought with him the proper sacrifice for our sin. And everything that came before this was just a shadow of the real thing, but this is the real thing. This is what the writer of Hebrews is saying. This is the real thing. This is where this was all leading. This is where this was all going all along. And we're not going to move on from this, the provisional reality of Christ's atoning sacrifice. There's still more for us to see here. There's still more for us to celebrate. But we are going to move into our last point now, which is how does the sacrifice of Jesus impact our lives of faith? I'm going to put this differently just in case it might be helpful, just based on some of the things we've been saying. You could put it like this. How does the provision of Jesus impact the practice of our faith? How does the provision of Jesus impact the practice of our faith? So let's read verses 13 and 14 now. How are we doing? We good? Quick note before I read this. Many of the translations begin with the word if, which I think is helpful. In other words, if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkled on those who were ceremonially unclean sanctify them so that they are outwardly clean. How much more then, that's why the if is important, how much more then will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself unblemished to God, how much more will the blood of Christ cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death so that we may serve the living God? So this talk of conscience, it's a hard word to say, our consciences, this is very interesting. This comes up twice. First, it comes up in verse 9. You might have picked up on this, where we read that the gifts and sacrifices being offered were not able to clear the conscience of the worshiper. They are only a matter of food and drink and various ceremonial washings, external regulations applying until the time of the new order. Comes up again in verse 14. How much more then will the blood of Christ through the eternal Spirit offered himself unblemished to God, how much more will his atoning work cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death so that we may serve the living God? What's the idea here? What is being talked about as it relates to the conscience? At the very least, we could say this much. I'll say a bit more than this, but at the very least, we could say this. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, was intended to purify all of the sins of the priest and of the people that were committed over the course of the previous year. All right? This was an annual practice. This happened again and again and again, year in and year out, this would take place. And it was gruesome. I don't know that we, like us moderns, I don't know that we can really get a handle of what this must have been like, just viscerally, like what this must have been like. Sacrifices were made, blood was spilled, and lots of it, lots of blood was shed. It was, from everything I've read about it, carnage. It was bloody. I don't know how else to put it. And what was it? It was a brutal reminder of the reality of our sin. This is what the people were faced with at least once a year. This visual reminder of the reality of our sin, that it leads to death, that it leads us away from God, and therefore it must be addressed, it must be atoned for, provision must be made for it, or else. Okay? But get this, the very next day, this is what I'm thinking about as it relates to the conscience. The very next day, right? So it atoned for the sins of the past year. The very next day, they were right back in the same hole again. Like getting out their calendars, like, okay, 364 more days. And, you know, I can sleep easy again. You see what I mean? No wonder they had a conscious problem. But I think it's much more than that. Like, notice what we're being told about the atoning sacrifice of Christ. Verse 14, one more time. It seems like I'm reading this stuff a lot, but let's just keep reading it. Let's keep allowing it to sink in. Verse 14, how much more then will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit, and I'm going to just hit pause there, not the annual Spirit, the eternal Spirit, who through the eternal Spirit. And then what does it say? It says that Jesus offered himself unblemished to God. Jesus offered himself for us. This is something that a bull and a goat can't do, right? That a bull or a goat can't consciously do. But Jesus did. He consciously offered himself on our behalf. And he did it through the eternal Spirit. This is a very Trinitarian act that is taking place. We have Father, Son, and Spirit. Everybody's involved. And what did he accomplish for us? And we can see it in verse 12. He obtained eternal redemption for us. Eternal redemption. Once for all who would receive it, and once for all time for all who would receive it. That's kind of riddlesome. But what does it mean? It means it's complete. What the Son of God has accomplished for us, what he's provided for us, it's complete. It is sufficient. It is effective. In the words of Christ, it is finished. Nothing is left undone. There is nothing more to do. There is no need for an annual renewal of some sort. What he's done is all sufficient and finished. And so how should this impact us? This is the question, right? This is where we want to end. How should this impact our lives of faith? And here I want to get at this conscious dynamic a bit more. How should the finished work of Jesus impact us? End of verse 14. It should, according to the writer of Hebrews, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death so that we may serve the living God. That's what it should do. What do I mean? I mean that understanding the atoning work of Jesus should result in assurance. This is an inner conscience thing. Assurance. Confidence. We're told that in chapter 4. Boldly approaching the throne of grace. It should result in a sense of security with God. That I am at one with him. And that nothing can create a cleft between me and God anymore, because what Jesus has done is everything I need. I can hide in him for all of time. And what this should result in, and I think that this is where the author is taking us, is it should result in this liberating experience of service and worship. And this is critical on this conscious thing. I really think that this is some of the most important implications and imports of the gospel of Jesus Christ to us. That we can begin now, if we're really taking in the full reality of the atoning sacrifice of Christ, we can begin now to freely serve God. Because what are we doing otherwise? And I think that we all know something about this. Otherwise, what are we doing? We're working, we're serving, we're kind of topsy-turvy. We're serving God in a shaky way, maybe even in a superstitious way, because we want to just stay in God's good graces. Oh, man, I've kind of had a bad week. Good day, bad day scenarios. Am I in the doghouse with God this week? I really haven't had a good week, and he knows it. And so, man, I just, you know, I better double. I mean, us guys got together for dinner the other night. We were talking about the potentially good embrace of spiritual disciplines and habits. But we were also talking about, like, what could be bad about them? Here's what could be bad about them: that we take them and we misuse them. We see them as a way to somehow get into God's good graces as though we weren't, or to leverage something with God, to manipulate God. All that, the atonement. Knocks it out. So understanding the atonement of Christ could be the difference between responsive worship and this, like, clunky reactionary life of faith, which we all know, I'm sure of it, this good day, bad day kind of approach to God. Jesus has abolished that. He's made a way so that you and I can have our consciences clear of acts that lead to death so that we can serve the living God. Jesus has done that for us. And we should live into that. We should really live into that. I'm going to end off here. I want to give you a picture of how radical and revolutionary this was for the early church. Okay, this is I've been kind of holding on to this, waiting for the right moment, and I feel like this is the right moment. This is from William Lane in his commentary on the book of Hebrews, and he's giving us a picture of what this would have looked like and the experience of it in the early church. He writes, Christians had none of the visible apparatus which in those days was habitually associated with religion and worship. No sacred buildings, no altars, no sacrificing priest. Their pagan neighbors thought they had no God. It's wild, right? Their pagan neighbors thought they had no God and called them atheists. Their Jewish neighbors, too, might criticize them for having no visible means of spiritual support. In other words, they looked like aimless, godless people because they didn't have any of the visual apparatus. They didn't have that sacrificial system in place. They weren't the cogs and the wheels of the sacrificial system weren't churning. Like, where are the goats? Where are the bulls? Like, where's the blood? You guys got no blood in your faith. You got no blood in your religion. And they're like, yes, we do. It's the blood of Christ. It's the atonement of Jesus once for all. And it's done. And now we worship and we serve the living God. That's what we're invited to do. What a privilege. What an amazing thing. Let me pray. Oh, Father, would you overcome all of the obstacles that exist within us, even within our consciences, all of the apparatus that we set up within ourselves that actually keep us from the real thing that you have laid down your life, that you have shed your blood, that you have allowed your life to be riven so that we could experience. Would you overcome all of those obstacles? Would you allow us to see the glory of the atoning sacrifice of Jesus and all that it holds for us? Would you free us up? Would you liberate us in such a way that we could, with lightness of being, with a clear conscience, serve the living God? Would you lead us in these ways, oh God? We thank you for your love shown to us in the face of Jesus Christ. We thank you that you are our living God. It's in Jesus' name we give thanks. Amen.